from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Dave Iverson. This hour, we're talking about foraging in the woods and at the water's edge. Since humankind walked the earth, we've been searching out tasty treats. It's only recently, in a world full of shrink-wrapped food delivered in trucks to the supermarket, that we seem to have lost the wisdom involved in living off the land. But the food is still there, and the Bay Area is blessed with more than its fair share of wise and passionate professional foragers. We've got them on forum today, ready and willing to share their wisdom about the natural world and all it has to offer the dinner table. Strap on your hiking boots and prepare to take notes. We'll be foraging on forum after this. This is Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Dave Iverson. A growing number of city slickers are foraging for fruit growing in a neighbor's backyard, for mushrooms in the local parks, for weeds by the roadside that might make a nice salad or go into a nice soup. We talk now with local foragers about how to hunt down and prepare dandelions, berries, snails, frogs, and other delicious delights. So joining us now, we have Corey Stewart, who's a local chef of the Americano Restaurant and Bar, one of many chefs who've taken up foraging with local talent that we have here in studio. Thank you for joining us, Corey. Oh, I guess he's not in yet. Oh, he is there. Hello, Corey. All right, we'll come back to you shortly. Okay. We have Kirk Lombard, fisherman and sea forager. He runs an intertidal tour business called Sea Forager and teaches people how to forage for fish, mollusks, and other ocean fare. Thank you for being here.
All right.
We have Hank Shaw on the line, author of Hunt, Gather, Cook, Finding the Forgotten Feast.
Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to have you with us. Iso Rabins, founder of Forage SF, Forage Kitchen, Underground Market, and Batch Made Market.
Good morning.
And last but not least, we have Connie Green, author of The Wild Table, a mushroom expert, well-beloved here in the Bay Area. She runs the oldest and biggest wild foods company in the Bay Area around since 1981. The Wine Forest provides wild mushrooms to about 70% of all the chefs in the city. Is that right?
I would guess that that's pretty close.
So we're all sitting around this massive basket of mushrooms. I'm wondering if you can tell us what it is we're looking at.
Oh, well, since I'm a fungal person, it's actually more, in a weird way, Kirk is the one that was looking at the green separating the chanterelles from the lobster mushrooms. All of these are not from the immediate Bay Area. They're from further up the Pacific coast, but not terribly far. There's lobster mushrooms, which are sort of two mushrooms in one. There's an exterior parasite mushroom on an incredibly boring white mushroom. So I've always referred to them as sort of the drag queen of mushrooms. It's two for one. It looks like one thing, but it's really another. And then there's sea beans, which are a very salty, crunchy plant of where freshwater hits salt water. And then the perennial favorite, chanterelles.
When did we start using fresh mushrooms to the extent that we use them now at home and in kitchens? It seemed, I guess, back in the 70s and the 80s, a lot of the mushrooms you got were things that had been dried beforehand or in soup cans.
When I started taking mushrooms into restaurants, the vast majority of chefs I dealt with had never seen a chanterelle before. So it hasn't been that long. But on the other hand, all that means is that we've joined a sort of worldwide love of mushrooms, that we were kind of the last to the party.
A lot of Americans who don't forage for their own mushrooms have heard the headline, "Be very careful, you can kill yourself and loved ones if you pick a mushroom that isn't safe to eat." How does somebody get started learning what mushrooms are safe to eat?
Well, I personally think it's a great idea. People should be afraid and leave them all for me. But Iso should probably answer that.
Iso?
Okay. A good way to get started. I think that
I mean, for me, like, whenever I'm learning something new, it's just, like, find someone who's really good at it and spend a lot of time with them. And I think that's especially good with mushrooms, you know, because there's so much. You can get a book, and, like, there's a lot of really good, like, beginner field guides. You kind of look at the pictures and, like, get a good idea of what they look like. But there's, like, so much more information. You're actually holding something, you know, like, about, like, the weight and the color and kind of, like, the place it grows. So I find that, yeah, just going out with someone and kind of just spending time with them is really the best way to start.
And is that the kind of thing you can do here in the Bay Area, or have we pretty much picked out all the mushrooms there are to pick out?
No. These are a sustainable thing. There's going to be probably numerous people calling or sitting at home thinking about what they're saying. And it's really important that people know that every one of these things, from his fish and eels to these mushrooms to all the wild things that we all deal with, every one of them has a different biology, a different sustainability level, and so on. Mushrooms, all of these mushrooms are a completely sustainable thing. You can go back and pick them every year.
Hank Shaw, I take it you get around in your foraging. You spend a lot of time in the Sierra Nevada?
I do.
Can you tell us about how it's different there or than it would be, say, in the Sacramento Delta or I guess, in Oakland?
Well, it's for the most part, it's drier. And, you know, you don't have the year-long season that you would on the coastal range because there's lots of snow in the Sierra. So, I'm sorry, I'm getting a horrific double, like I hear my voice twice.
Okay, really you're getting a little bit of feedback. So let's turn to Kirk now. And Kirk, before I let you start talking, we have got to play a little bit of this fabulous video I believe a New York Times team made not too long ago.
Okay.
Of you enjoying the fruits of your labor is the best way to put it.
Dream fishing? Is
that with your wife.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
All for me fish, me tasty, tasty fish. All for me seaweeds and mussels. For there's nothing greater than a meal we gather with our hands and catch by means of hooks and lines and sinkers.
So, I have to ask, is it your diet that makes you so chipper?
Yeah, it must be. It's all the eels I eat.
So, did you learn to sing sea shanties, essentially, along with the foraging, or is that something that you were raised with?
Yeah, I come from a showbiz family, and all my people are from musical comedy and vaudeville and everything, going back 100 years.
And were they also shellfish foragers, or is that something you picked up on your own?
I kind of picked that up on my own, although my grandfather was a hunter and a fisherman. That's where I learned pretty much everything from my gramps, from my grandfather back in the day. He lived in Santa Cruz as a kid and used to regale me with stories of oceanic abundance and fishing steelhead on the rivers and all this kind of stuff.
So I think a lot of Americans have grown up with the old adage, don't fish off the pier, you know, usually said in very, you know, grim tones. What is it you can fish for, hunt for, and expect some pretty tasty, safe-to-eat stuff?
Well, so I noticed that the topic here on the website was urban foraging, right? So there's a lot of people in the Bay Area who are foraging their dinner and their protein mostly out of the bay. And obviously there are, you know, there's some issues, health issues involved in that. But as I tell people on my tour, I lead these walking tours around the San Francisco shoreline, sort of intertidal tours. And what I always tell people is if you're going to do that, feed low on the food chain. So, you can go to the health department website. The OEHHA has an incredible list of all these different toxins and things that are in local fish. And it'll give you a guideline to look at what is reasonably safe to eat out of the bay. And it's all the stuff that's lower on the food chain, schooling fishes, herrings, smelts, this kind of stuff.
You've said in previous interviews that in part you're making your living thanks to the failure of generations of fathers who have not taught their sons and daughters how to do this kind of thing.
Well, yeah, you know, you could frame. I guess I did frame it that way. I do. I get a lot of people on my tours that they are fascinated with just doing fishing knots, you know, basic fishing knots, or they just don't know the different types of species that live in the bay. And I'll just talk about that. They find the regulations a total mystery, so I explain the regulations to them, this kind of thing, yeah.
It's an easy living.
Well, I don't know how easy it is, but it's fun, and I love it.
Issa Ravens, who are the people who show up on your tours?
All kinds of different people. Kirk actually teaches one of our tours, sea foraging tours, but we also do kind of more wild plant tours on the city. And also, we also teach mushroom tours. We'll like take people to the Sierras and like go morel foraging with them. And it's really all kinds of different people. I think that it's kind of, to speak to Kirk's point, that people have just gotten so far away from this stuff that even like the most basic knowledge, they're just so excited about, you know, like just the idea that you could eat something from the outside. I think that like that's a big leap for people, you know? So it's like, so if you go on a tour and you learn about like 7 different edible plants, the people are like just totally blown away by it.
Are you looking at people who are of all ages, of all ethnic backgrounds?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of a lot of like San Francisco, like 20 to 30 something.
Some computer programmers.
Totally.
Too much time in front of the screen.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I think like, all these kids, they make like 250 grand work for Facebook, but they spend like 12 hours a day on their computer. And then just the idea of like going outside and like eating something from outside, it's just like so like revolutionary to them, you know, they just really, really enjoy it. So it is a mix. We've done some tours for kids. We do some like private tours for people. But yeah, I think it's just anybody who's kind of interested in getting out there.
Connie Green, I guess so much of foraging starts with the idea of just opening your eyes to what's around you.
But of course, you know, and it's very much a part of who we are, whether we think so or not, because, you know, I know that both Kirk and Issa have had the same experience of there'll be that one person that they will see their first whatever it might be, and you watch them and they blush and bloom like flowers. And it's something that's very intrinsic in us, you know, it's just something that we are the offspring of people and survivors, and we're part of the gene pool of the really good hunters and gatherers. We're the survivors of that. So that little spark occurs with all of us. I don't take people on tours, but for years and years I take chefs out mushroom hunting primarily. And I mean, I've seen hardened, knife-wielding, tough men weep in the woods from finding like their first porcini. They just can't. They're overwhelmed with joy.
Along those lines, we are calling up one of your acolytes, a chef who here in the Bay Area, who learned to forage from you. Is it something where do you take them to forage? Do you do it here, I guess, or when I say here in San Francisco, do you go further afield, wine country?
Well, I sort of take, because I'm not in the business of taking people on tours, but these guys are my darlings. These, you know, the chefs, all this great food that we all eat in San Francisco celebrated restaurants, what people forget is these guys are locked up in, and women are locked up in hot kitchens for 14 hours a day. They don't see where their food's coming from. So one of the most extreme pleasures they can get is being taken far away off in the woods.
So, Corey Stewart, we've got you on the line finally. Tell us, why does it matter whether you pick the mushroom or Connie picks the mushroom and delivers it to you at your at Americana restaurant?
Well, I mean, the quality of what Connie brings us, of course, is the same, but it's just an amazing experience to go out and see it in its natural environment. Like Connie was saying, it has a great way of restoring you after many long hours and days in a kitchen, and gives you a whole new respect for what goes into gathering these foods.
It's not just something showing up in a tray in abundance, so that it almost seems like it comes off of some assembly line.
That's exactly right. And I mean, there's always a variability to these wild foods. There's you know, inconsistencies, and the seasons come and go really quickly sometimes. But it gives you something to look forward to, and it's really special when they are here. And since I've been out there in the woods and realized how hard it is to see a black trumpet mushroom, and you think about what somebody has to go through picking 10 or 15 or 20 pounds of those in a day.
So what do you do with the mushrooms that you've picked?
So we do a number of different things. I mean, at this point, fortunately, we're able to get wild mushrooms year-round. Chanterelles almost, you know, 10 months out of the year. And on our menu, we use them in pastas and on pizzas and various main courses. Of course, we'll serve them with fish and meat, too. But we also have a on our menu all the time, a candy cap mushroom ice cream sandwich. Candy caps are these little mushrooms that they actually grow in our area. We're fortunate to have an abundance of them here, but not many other places. And when you dry them, they taste just like maple syrup. They're not sweet, but they have the aroma of maple syrup. And we turn that into an ice cream that we serve along with these butterscotch pecan cookies.
I should mention, we have that recipe on our website, along with very fun videos of both Connie and Kirk, kqed.org/form, where you can also leave comments and questions for this conversation. Hank Shaw, I don't want to leave you out there hanging in Sacramento. Is there something, I don't know, echoing through our genes that calls us into the woods to go get dinner as opposed to have it delivered?
I mean, all animals do better when they have to work for their food. I mean, there's a famous Temple Grandin experiment they did. She did it in a zoo with big cats. And the big cats were all sad. And they were just moping around and not doing very much. And so she looked at the problem, and the problem was that the cats basically had pieces of meat thrown at them. It's essentially a Walmart of a zoo. And she developed this experiment that required the cats to solve a problem to get their food. And all of a sudden, the cats were happy again. And the problem changed all the time. And it's, you know, that's sort of an animal behavioral version of any time anybody has ever caught a trout for their dinner and enjoyed that trout on a frying pan on a camping trip. You know that trout tastes infinitely better than you would get at any restaurant or cooked in your home kitchen because you worked for it. And that's hardwired within us.
It's an interesting story how you got into it. I'm wondering if you could share it with our listeners.
I've been doing it since I was born, really. I mean, it's not really, I really didn't get into it. I was born into it. So I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, you know, who taught you? How did you get started?
Well, it's part of my family's culture. My mom and my sisters, they've been, you know, taught me how to pick berries and dig clams and fish. And it's been something that we've been doing for, you know, for as long as we've all been alive. And, you know, it's what I try to do is try to bring that sense of normalcy to foraging and fishing and hunting that, you know, lots of people don't have. I mean, a lot of people think it's super exotic or you have to go faraway places. And it really is just, no, it's about not being green blind anymore. I mean, it's most people look out into the forest or into the woods or into a park and they just see green. And until you know the difference between plant A and plant B and plant C, it's all going to just be this green wall. And what I hope to do is to make people see the bricks in the wall.
So you used to study the wild animals of Sacramento, people like Arnold Schwarzenegger. How did you make the shift into full-time foraging?
Oh, God.
It was kind of made for me. The newspaper I was working for closed its bureau, and I did work for another publication called the Capital Morning Report for a little while. But the website, which is Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook, I started that website in 2007 as a way to keep myself sane because, you know, if you cover politics all day, as I did, you know, you need a break. And it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then in 2010, I thought I might be able to do this. And so far, so good.
So Hank and Kirk went on a foraging trip recently. Kirk, do you want to talk about that one?
Sure. We went clamming.
And where'd you go?
Oh, how do you...
She keeps asking these location questions.
Yeah, yeah. We went on the California coast, and we found a really lovely gravelly area, and it was, like, loaded with little neck clams, which is... It's difficult. I mean, you can get a lot of little neck clams out of San Francisco Bay and Manila clams, but that's a little... There's, you know, toxic loads in those clams that we don't even want to imagine.
So it does pay to go a little further afield.
Well, for some things, and then some things I actually do go down to the the local pier. So like when the herring are running, I go right out in the bay. So it depends on the species.
So I have to admit, I've only ever gotten my little neck clams at fish stores.
Yeah, that's right? That's
somebody hands it to me at Tokyo Fish in Berkeley. So if I were like to go to a beach where these little neck clams were in abundance,
okay,
what do I physically do to get the clam in my hands?
Well, now you're totally in my power now because I could make you look like a real fool.
Oh, no, I already do. Go ahead.
Okay. No, you would get yourself a rake and you would find a little gravelly, cobbly area and you rake down. The little necks and manillas in our area usually live, 4 to 8 inches down. And you rake them up.
Just rake them up.
Replace your, if you're causing a big disturbance in the intertidal region, then rake it back over when you're done. And follow the regulations.
This raises a good point, though. I mean, if you have, I could say it, hordes of hipsters, combing the beachfront,
right,
looking for the clams, we might not have any very, very quickly. It doesn't take that many people to just kind of ruin it for everyone.
Right, which is why I'm not broadcasting the location, for one thing. And it's one thing I always try to avoid on my tours is telling people exactly where to go. Also, I really try to stress the management of these species and the importance of following the rules. I have a management background. I worked for the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission for 7 years. And
So what's an example of a rule that you'd have to follow?
On my tour, I get into this because very often there's a difference between legality and ethics. So in the state of California, for some reason, clammers who dig a species called the horseneck clam, a euphemistically titled creature, if ever there was one. People who dig the horseneck clam will dig these monstrous holes because they live 3 to 4 feet down, right?
Right.
And so there's no regulation that says you have to fill in that hole after you do it. But the problem there is that if you don't fill in the hole, then what you're creating is a very loosely packed mud flat in which a lot of creatures will die. So although legally, you can just dig and leave these holes all over the mudflats. I try to stress to people the importance of following the ethics, not just the code of the law. Fill that hole in. Don't always feel like you have to take a limit of clams every time you go out. My God, horseneck clams, I've gotten them up to 4 and 5 pounds. I mean, how much clam meat do you really need? And I try to stress this to the people who are interested in doing this.
Well, Corey, are you planning to go on any foraging trips in the near future?
Well, I mean, I spend a lot of the summertime waiting for the rain to come because that's kind of what brings the first of our local mushrooms. And, interestingly, in the Bay Area, you look out in the hills and everything's brown because it's dry, of course. So there's not a lot in the way of wild forage greens at this moment. Even the mustards and everything are all gone to flower and kind of strong. So I'm waiting for those first rains, and those tend to bring the porcinis and other bullets in our area.
Well, Corey Stewart, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Corey Stewart is the chef at Americano Restaurant and Bar, one of many chefs who forage with Connie Green in search of mushrooms. And you can check out a lot of his food on the menu of that restaurant. Are you a forager? What do you like to forage for? Call us at 866-733-6786 or email us at forum@kqed.org. Post on our Facebook page. We're ready and waiting for your comments and questions. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Dave Iverson. We're talking about foraging in the Bay Area and talking about the sustainability or lack thereof of foraging in the Bay Area. Kirk Lombard, I'd like you to expand a little bit on some of the bad behavior you've seen on beaches, I suppose south of here as well. When people go for those little neck clams or those horseneck clams, they sometimes leave those big holes gaping in the sand.
Right. Well, yeah, I was just covering that. It's an issue because it's not don't have to legally fill them in, but ethically, it kind of ruins the mud flat if you don't do that. So if you go to Washington, you get a $300 ticket for not doing that. So for some reason, digging the same clam in the same kind of ecosystem here is not a ticket. I wish it was.
Connie Green, there's also another issue as well that lots of Californians over the years, over the generations, have brought in non-native plants and animals, for that matter, into their gardens, into their farms to grow on an agricultural basis, and they sneak into the wildlands, the parks that we love to forage in.
Yeah, that probably started back in the 15, 1600s, however, and then out here as well. But this is something that the average urban person can have a great time. I mean, I have been in people's backyards here in San Francisco and found at least four edible greens, you know, in a space that's about 30 feet by 30 feet. And this can be harvested. These are not only sustainable, but for God's sakes, people would almost pay you to eat them. You know, it's sort of, you can
make a naturalist happy.
Yeah, I think of this as we could be sort of the human weeder geese of because there's magnificent, delicious edibles that are invading species that it became are now so desirable that they've gone from at one time cultivated species in Europe and Asia to being invading species in the United States to be regarding as a wild, delectable edible to now having farmers realize, hey, I have a whole crop here, and harvesting their weeds as something to sell at the farmer's market, and then going beyond that and planting crops like stinging nettles, purslane, chickweed, some of these things that grow in lots of places, and turning it back into an agriculture, from a wild thing back into an agricultural crop, because they are delicious.
Issa Rabins, that sounds like a good tour, like the invasive species tour.
Totally. I mean, that's the thing. Most of the stuff that we teach about is our invasive species or weeds. You know, like if we weren't, we get a lot of questions about like sustainability, especially with urban foraging. And there is that idea like, well, if you teach people about this thing, like everyone's going to do it. And then before you know it, like none of these things will be around. But I think that the reality is that there are so many of them around, and if we don't pick them, honestly, like usually they get mowed down, you know, or like pulled out. Like I always see something I really like in the city is wild onions, and they'll be like, they're kind of like, they're like wild scallions, and they have these little white flowers. And you'll see gardeners with like truckloads of these things they've weeded from people's backyards. And then you go down to the ferry building and you buy them for like $8 a pound. It's like the exactly right. same plant, you know? So it's just kind of interesting. It is really just like opening your eyes and being like, okay, like this stuff's really around.
We're putting out the calls to listeners for your questions and comments. 866-733-6786. Let's talk first to Line in Kensington.
It's Ron.
Oh, Ron. Sorry.
No problem. I've been a forager for a long time, more than 40 years, including foraging for some very prominent local restaurants at times. And I have to say that I wish that foraging practices were as sustainable as are being portrayed. But I have to say that what I've seen has been very disturbing at times.
And can you give us an example?
Sure. Well, I'll give you a couple. One of them is ramps. They are a wild garlic or wild onion. They grow in our Sierras. They grow a lot of places. And there are places I used to go back and get a few, you know, for myself or a few customers every year. And I would then I would go back to that place after a few years and find that it had been just torn apart, that the species no longer existed there because they've been picked to death. I also see in hunting for particularly chanterelles and porcini, huge mobs of groups. They tend to be, for reasons that beyond the particular ethnic group, that go in and just pick a place clean, or people go in with rakes and disturb the forest floor and the forest stuff so much that it will be years before some of these mushrooms will come back again. We really need a kind of a licensure environment so that people who do this responsibly.
Connie Green, I see you shaking your head here. You want to add in?
Yeah, I do. I agree with him about getting licenses. I really do. And in fact, they do exist in much of the national forest land. They do. But one of the things...
They're not really licenses.
No, there's actually licenses as well.
They don't teach you much about how to do it.
All right. Yes, they do. There's whole videos and entire programs in Oregon and a lot of places in this country. But There is, I have done this for going on 40 years, and there has been, I mean, David Aurora has worked very hard to fight some of this. There's been a long tradition of wives' tales, and I'll give you an example. Ramps do not exist west of the Mississippi. So what you are seeing and what you're talking about, there are no ramps west of the Mississippi. Do you understand? So these sorts of things are, you know, a problem when people tend to repeat wives' tale or will take other people's experience. It's a bit like playing telephone. So it's very hard. You really have to be on the ground and see this, because some of this stuff that's reporting, I know we're going to hear some of this stuff, and like, for example, what this man has just said is simply not true.
But let me ask you, Connie, I mean, I have been to a lot of state parks, just covering state parks a lot in the last couple of years, and the rangers and the volunteers tell me that there are lots of local populations who come in, you know, maybe for generations, you know, their forefathers in Poland ate a certain kind of fern, and so they're combing through a state park looking for this stuff, sometimes mistakenly picking a cousin of the plant that they remembered so fondly, a cousin that might even be toxic to humans. And, you know, with one ranger and 5 or 20 volunteers in a huge state park, this is not a practice that can be stopped. How do we get across, I guess, the education that this kind of thing isn't wise, isn't thoughtful for the larger community?
I think that educating people about wild foods and wild mushrooms is actually like a positive, sustainable practice. I think that as you start to understand kind of the environments of these different plants, you start to understand like where they are, you start to see, you know, when they're in season, when they're out of season. It really just gives you like a much deeper connection with your environment than I think a lot of people kind of, you go to a park and like it's very beautiful and we have this like take, you know, leave no trace, take nothing idea. But I think that what that does is really like separates you from your environment in this way that like, that makes you not necessarily care as much what happens to that space. But once you start foraging, it really makes you start to notice, makes you, you know, like speaking to Kirk's point about like filling back in the holes. Like if you weren't a forager, you wouldn't even notice those holes. You wouldn't notice that was happening. But like,
maybe cultivating a sense of ownership. Like this is my beach. This is my wood.
So on my tour, a lot of my tours, anyone who has taken it can attest, is I talk a lot about rules and regulations. I talk a lot about the different ecosystems and what is dependent on, you know, we talk about fat innkeeper worms, which has a different name on my blog, but I don't know if I can say that on the air.
Careful, this is family radio.
Yeah, it's family radio. From my point of view, the reason I got into this is because I really enjoy the educational aspect of this. I also like telling fish stories. But my feeling is that people who are looking at the environment as if they are part of it, as if they are part of the ecosystem, which we all are, but if you're actually harvesting your food from nature, you're going to care more about it that because you're eating it. I think that that's a sacred act, that you catch something and you eat it. That's a fundamental part of being human and being an animal, just like Hank was kind of alluding to. And I think that people who are wresting their food from the environment are going to care more about it. And I try, on my tour at least, I try to have an educational aspect to make sure people are getting that.
Hank Shaw, do you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, sure. I think what the caller was referring to wasn't ramps, but with Sierra wild onions, which look a little bit like a ramp. It's a different onion, but it has that purple shank, and it looks vaguely like a ramp. I've never actually seen a Sierra wild onion spot get whacked, but I'm sure it happens. And that brings up to tie bow on this. I mean, if anybody's ever grown anything or farmed anything, you just don't eat your seed corn. And you know, I have all kinds of onion spots, and yeah, you kill onions to harvest them. So you harvest a little and move. I mean, the general forager's rule is you take, you know, everybody's number's different, but it's anywhere from 10 to 25% of any given patch of anything, because you want it to look like you were never there. when you finish foraging any particular spot. And you stick and move and stick and move and stick and move and eventually get whatever it is you need. And then you leave and look back and it shouldn't look like you were there at all. So, yeah, I mean, there's a level of ethics and a level of technique involved with where you don't, you know, I can't say it any quicker or more succinct than you just don't eat your seed corn, because otherwise you won't be able to go back next year and you'll have to spend more gas and more time finding another spot because you killed that first one.
With that, let's turn back to the phones and Scott in Auburn.
Hi. Yeah, thanks. My wife and I grew up in the Bay Area and started foraging as teenagers. There was a woman and her husband in Berkeley, Karen Howling Wolf, who used to take people on tours and up in the Oakland Hills, and she taught us a lot about the different plants. We moved to Auburn here in 79, and we've done a lot of foraging and go on forays with the Mycological Society out of Davis. And, we bought a permit from the El Dorado National Forest this year. It's a year-long permit for gathering mushrooms, just not commercially. You're not supposed to gather
do it for
commercially
profit, yeah.
on the Forest Service lands. Have seen some areas where commercial foragers have left their garbage behind. They shouldn't do that. But today I was out for a run, and I came across a gray squirrel that seems like it's always their head that gets run over, and the body was still warm. So I picked it up by the tail and ran home and skinned it, and it's cooking right now.
What are you making with it?
Oh, stew. It smells real good.
So what do you put in a roadkill squirrel stew?
Well, I put a clove of garlic in there and some frozen chicken stock that I had and some bean stock. We froze a lot of beans yesterday. And once it gets soft, I'll just take all the meat off the bone and start adding vegetables and barley. It's kind of like a turkey soup. It's very good.
Wow. Hank Shaw, is that what you would do with some squirrel if you had it?
Absolutely not. That's a case where it is ethical but not legal. That's a crime in the state of California.
Really? Wow.
Absolutely. You cannot touch any roadkill.
Why does that law exist?
You'd have to ask the person who wrote it, but my thinking is that it was geared for deer, and it's to keep people from whacking deer on purpose so that they can throw them in the back of the truck. But it is strictly verboten to pick up roadkill in California.
Well, the irony of that is the only car I saw on the loop up there was a county sheriff, so he probably is the one that didn't slow down. For the
I know. I mean...
well...
the turkey vulture lobby...
Well, with that, let's go to another call. Thank you so much, Scott. That was awesome. Let's talk to Dale in San Francisco.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'm the president of Fort Mason Community Garden, and it's 100% organic, and we have wonderful critters there all the time. But I'm calling because years ago, I was teaching at California State University, Chico, and And the reason for the call is that people can go out in their the hinterlands and find places because orchards need to glean. That means clean the nuts and the fruit away from the bottoms of the trees. And every year I got 100 pounds of almonds. I would harvest several bags of gunny sacks, and I'd get a 100-pound bag of meats back from the processor, and walnuts, and once I got 15 gallons of first-press olive oil.
Ooh.
And so don't, expand your horizons, not just to your backyard, where there's lots of good things to eat, but also to, the Napa, Sonoma, there's plenty of places out there.
Winters, I imagine, east of Sacramento, there have got to be some awesome orchards to glean. Connie?
Well, just in Napa, where I come from, there's second crop fruit, the second crop grapes. You know, a lot of the farmers want those off, but it's not economically viable to harvest them as a commercial crop. So that's where a lot of homemade wine comes from.
Yeah, you can definitely do that in the city, too. I mean, there's an amazing amount of fruit in the city. Like, I grew up in Vermont, where, like, the idea of figs growing in your backyard or lemons is, like, totally ridiculous. So coming out here, it's like, people have a fig tree in their backyard, and they'll have, like, thousands of figs on it. And they're just, like, they're just dropping and rotting. So, like, what we do a lot is, like, is go a lot in the East Bay and just ask people if we can harvest their fruit, and you get a ton of stuff that way.
So you're following the rules of etiquette, though, and asking. I hear from some homeowners that they'll just wake up in the morning and find neighbors or complete strangers picking at their trees.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You gotta ask.
Pomegranates are especially targets. I have a friend who's got a pomegranate tree in their front yard, and they have to keep vigilant. There will literally be dudes who roll up in a van, pick the tree and zoom off, like, because it's a buck of pomegranate. So there's a dark side to that too.
Yes, the it's a good point. You know, I'm wondering. One of our listeners asked Connie, why are prices for chanterelles not dropping in the markets, even though it's kind of prime season?
Oh, it's not prime season.
It's not prime season.
No, it's just beginning in North America right now. It's just begun up in northern. Canada. It's funny. Wild mushrooms, the harvest of them worldwide, is one of the things that you become profoundly aware of climate change. So we have years that are fabulous. We have years that are very poor. And we're in the process of finding out what kind of year it'll be. But it's just beginning.
It's just beginning.
It was hell of a chanterelle year in Georgia and Louisiana.
Yeah.
Yeah, down there they had a great year.
They had huge rains.
I suppose if you're not foraging, you can be thrown off by the fact that you're seeing these beautiful chanterelles flown in from Georgia or mm-hmm. Canada. You lose touch with when the seasons are.
Well, a lot of these places, like in Canada, where these come from, are places where it's income for an entire small town in a very, very remote place where most of these things come from. So it ends up being something that rivals logging. So that there's, from standing forest, from living forest, they're harvesting mushrooms in a lot of these very small places instead of, it's a longer term income for these communities than logging.
Allison writes, when foraging in parks or roadsides, how can you find out if the area has been sprayed? Can you effectively clean what you find so it doesn't matter?
You can usually tell. I mean, like, obviously, like, the reason people spray is to kill plants. So if the plant's dead, it's probably been sprayed. You know, you can also see it, too. You can see, like you can look at one area and just see the side that's sprayed, and it'll be, like, all withered and dead. But, yeah, I mean, it is important to kind of be aware of where you're foraging. A lot of this stuff does grow, like, up along the roadside. So you try to be there less. But, I mean, something I always tell people also, though, is, like, a lot of the wine, you know, that comes from up north is grown right along that same highway. So it's like if you're collecting fennel, it's like right next to the wine grapes. It's kind of the same thing.
Richard writes, I've clammed on the east end of Long Island my entire life. I've lived here in the Bay Area for almost 30 years and have yet to find a little neck or cherry stone anywhere in this area. Please, I think he's talking to you, Kirk. Please give me a little hint as to where to find them. Also, King Boletes.
The King Boletes.
And Santa Claus, I want a pony, too. Yeah.
There are no King Boletes in California.
No. And, they're all mine.
Actually, there are.
What is a King Bolete for those who?
That's Porcini.
Boletus agilis. Yeah. We're in the press. There's renamed. There's the constant splitters and subspecies renamers and so on.
So basically, to answer the clam end of that, yeah, if he's looking for cherry stones on the Pacific Coast, it's going to be a long search. The little neck clam that we have here is not the same species as the Atlantic little neck, which, as far as I know, Atlantic clams, they're all quahogs and they're all graded by size. But here we have the Pacific little neck clam or the common little neck clam, and that can be found on gravelly areas generally inside bays. We can actually find them on the open coast too. If this caller or emailer wants more information, you should just email me.
And I should mention, we have a lot of resources on the website, kqed.org/forum. Beth writes, I highly recommend a new book, The Mushroom Hunters, On the Trail of an Underground America by Langdon Cook. And I wanted to throw that to you guys. If you could name one book that is very specifically helpful for Northern California, what would it be? Do you want to go around the table? But I'll start with Hank Shaw so you're not left out there.
Probably Charlotte Bringle Clark's Edible and Useful Plants of California. It was written in 1967 and then revised in 74. It's kind of the Bible of the sport. But, you know, got to say Connie's book is pretty good, too.
Oh, Hank, yours is fabulous.
It's a mutual respect club here. Connie?
Well, because mushrooms are my great love, I don't think you can do better than Mushrooms Demystified by David Aurora. It's really quite still the Bible.
Isa?
There's this book I found when I first moved here, when I first started foraging, called Flavors of Home. And
oh, it's a great book.
I love that book. Yeah, and it's like out of print, but I think...
Yeah, good luck finding it.
I know, yeah, you can't find it anywhere. And like
stay
on
away
eBay,
from
it's
my
like
bookshelves.
$120, you know, but... Yeah, it's this woman from Berkeley, and it's just all edible plants of the Bay Area, and she has these, like, awesome pictures, and it just has this, like, really nice homemade feel. It's a great book if you can find it.
Kirk?
Okay. It's hard for me because I read a lot, so I don't know. There's a great book called Foraging the California Coast by Peter Howarth, which is now, I believe, it might be out of print, or I don't know. I'm not exactly sure. I have, like, three copies. And another book that I personally gives you a lot of really great information, almost too much really, is the ponderously titled Certainly More Than You Want to Know About the Fishes of the Pacific Coast, A Postmodern Experience by Milton Love, who's one of the most esteemed biologists on the West Coast of North America.
Well, fabulous recommendations, all of them. I think we have time for at least one more call, and that would be Mary Louise in Palo Alto.
Thank you. Yes. So I would just like to mention, first of all, about John Muir, who used to go up in the Sierras. Mm. And basically all he took with him when he left was almonds. And he put almonds in his pocket, and that was that. And then beyond that, he found what he needed to eat. So that was my first point. And then I also wanted to mention something which will probably make people laugh, but anyway. I had the company of a rabbit for a few months. And while I had this rabbit, I did little testing. I would make a big tray, and I would put different growing things on the tray. So I kept track of what it was. And then watched the rabbit eat. And I found that basically the rabbit ate everything that I thought was edible and left the other things. I don't think it's a real scientific experiment, but it was fun to do.
And you're still alive to tell us about it.
I'm alive. Okay, so that's what I wanted to mention.
Thank you so much, Mary Louise.
Thank you.
Lisa writes, I'm a native of Inverness, and I've been fishing and foraging since I was three. A most memorable repast was on a small stretch of beach on Tomales Bay that belonged to my dad. We put the little necks we harvested onto a bed of seaweed on top of the dying down coals of a beach fire, put another layer of seaweed on top, and let them steam. After they opened, we dipped them in butter. We'd melted near the coals. Absolute heaven. It's childhood memories like that that keep me as engaged in foraging, and I'm now teaching my grandson these wonderful skills. Dana writes, I find so many wonderful fruits from trees lining our streets, plums, peaches, strawberry trees, and then, of course, all the blackberries and weeds. I walk my dog and eat as I go. It's wonderful. I wonder if Dana is asking everybody that she picks from. Thanks for the great show. I forage all the time. And Richard from Richmond asks, why can't porcini be grown domestically?
Ooh. Well, you know, this is one of the mystiques of wild food. There's a lot of these things that defy human cultivation. Humans have never tamed them. And porcini. Chanterelles, you know, there's a felt. It's a little complicated, but by and large, the majority of wild mushrooms cannot be cultivated. You need to grow a whole forest. If you want to do that, go right ahead.
Yeah, I've heard about these projects. They're like, they're trying to cultivate chanterelles, and it's like a 50-year project. Well, you know, like growing, you like have to grow a forest and then like hope they show up, or like truffles.
But I think that because, well, the mushrooms that are here on this table right now, they need a tree to grow. They begin to grow as very, you know, small tree mushrooms. They often grow up together. I pick chanterelles from trees that are probably 400 years old. They've existed in a state of symbiosis for all this time. And a lot of us aspire to live in symbiosis the same way these mushrooms and other things do with one another.
Do you think you get more pleasure from the things that you can't find cultivated?
Oh, that's a very good question.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah. All wild foods, yeah. I mean, I think it's like, you know, Kirk was talking about this a little bit before, but there just is something about catching your own food or foraging your own food and then cooking it that you, it's an experience you really just don't have with, you know, getting it from the supermarket. And it's really interesting to think about, like, how short of a time it's been since people just did this all the time. You know, the fact that there's, like, we're on a radio show about this topic now, like, you know, 70 years ago, that would have seemed ridiculous. You know, like, it's interesting, like, how quickly we forget this stuff, you know, and how interesting it becomes because of that.
Well, Iso Rabins, I'm going to have to give you the last word. Thank you so much to our guests, Iso Rabins, founder of Forage SF, Connie Green, author of The Wild Table, about mushrooms, a mushroom expert, Hank Shaw, author of Hunt, Gather, Cook, Finding the Forgotten Feast, Kirk Lombard, fisherman and sea forager. Thank you all for joining us. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and the executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns are Maddie Pelton, Keelan Cronin, Asal Asanipur, Evelyn Wang, and Jonathan Tam, with assistance for our foraging show from Gina Shalaba. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Dave Iverson. Thanks for joining us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.